Thank you for joining us tonight or this morning, wherever you are, listening to Coast AM. Connie here. We have some great products on the coasttocoastam.com. Go to the Coast to Coast AM store there, and you're going to see some neat mugs and travel mugs as well. And actually, there's a couple mugs. I like them. I'm looking at them right now. You need to go check them out, too. I really like that there's a men's T-shirt and a woman's T-shirt, and I like that the woman's is a V-neck. I like that. It looks much better than the crew. You guys can have the crew neck. We want the V-neck. It looks so much better. We got a hat and everything, too. So please be sure to check that out at coasttocoastam.com. We've got Stanley Swan. More to come with him here next year on Coast to Coast AM. Stay with us. With stations all over the U.S., North America, Puerto Rico, Guam, and by satellite, we are Coast to Coast AM. Connie Willis here, your host tonight, along with Stanley Swan, author of Undertakings of an Undertaker, and lots of neat little stories of over 30 years of doing this in his life. Stanley, we are to the point of my third life where I've passed away, and you are going to pick me up here from the studio. There's no foul play, and I want to be buried.
Right. Nine lives. We have six other scenarios.
Oh, no, this is it. Only three have gone. Okay. Three's a charm right now.
Yeah, all right. So now you have told your funeral director that you want a traditional, what we call a traditional service, which would include an embalming for viewing by your family and friends, if you wished, a public service. So basically what we would do, we would retrieve you from the place of death, take you back to the funeral home, take you into our operating room, which is called a preparation room, and we put you on most funeral homes have a stainless steel embalming table. Most preparation rooms are antiseptic. They almost look like operating rooms in a hospital. They have to be because they're all licensed by their respective states that they do business in, and they are subject to inspection at any time, so they have to be kept clean and aseptic, and that's just that. Good things for people to know that that's going on out there. So basically, when we get you back to the funeral home, we put you on the embalming table. What we're going to be doing first is we're going to wash the body completely. We are going to close and disinfect your eyes, your nose, and your mouth. Depending on how long you've passed away, if within a couple of hours of death, you're going to start losing some color. You're going to go to a paler look because your blood has started to gravitate to the lower portions of your bodies, and that is called liver mortis, where your blood starts settling to pools in the lower part of the body. So your color is already starting to change within a couple of hours, and most funeral directors like to do an embalming. I always like to do embalming as quickly after death as possible. The longer that you wait, you have problems with clotting within the circulatory system. So we like to embalm as quickly as we can. So we're going to wash the body totally and disinfect the eyes, the nose, and the mouth, and then we're going to start what we call an arterial injection. And what we're going to do here is probably, if it's a normal death and you're a normal deceased person, not overweight, no physical injuries, abnormalities, burns, scar tissues, things like that. We're going to make a small incision at the neckline, and we're going to raise what we call a carotid artery, pardon me, and a jugular vein. Circulatory system, of course, is a circle system where vessels carrying fresh blood are in your arteries, and then the return blood in the venous system. So we're going to raise that carotid artery and its accompanying jugular vein. And then we're going to mix up some what we would call pre-injection fluid. That fluid would be the first that would be injected into the arterial system. Basically, Connie, what that does is it kind of adjusts the pH of the body a little bit, and it kind of starts breaking up those blood clots, which are going to start forming very quickly upon death. Well, normally we would let that solution sit in a body for, I might let a pre-injection solution sit for 10, 15 minutes before I'd actually start following that with an arterial embalming solution. The embalming solution is a formaldehyde base. There are a number of different embalming chemicals that are used by a number of companies today. All the embalming chemicals are still pretty much formaldehyde based, although they have some new chemicals they are introducing now. Formaldehyde is quite dangerous to work with for funeral directors.
And why is that?
It's very astringent. It's very deadly to living tissue, so you have to be very careful with being splashed with embalming fluid. Whether we would get it in our eyes, on our skin, we have to wash it immediately. A good embalmer is going to wear protective gear, which is gloves, gown, facial mask to keep anything from splashing into him or her as she is embalming the body. That would include not only the chemicals that they're using, but any bloodborne that might be splashed as well while they're embalming. So we're going to start embalming the body, usually 4 to 6 ounces of embalming fluid per gallon of water in an embalming machine, and that's going to be injected into the carotid artery at probably 15 to 20 pounds pressure, PSI, and that will start pushing the fluid into your circulatory system, and that's going to push the old blood back out of the venous system, and the vein is going to be drained of the blood as the arterial solution is being injected. So as the injection is going in, the blood is being removed from the body. And that's going to take, depending on if there's no complications, could be a couple of hours to embalm a body. That's the first part of it. That's the arterial part of the embalming. After that is finished, and if the director is satisfied with the work that he's done, if he has good fluid distribution to your arms, legs, etc., then he'll follow up with treating the cavities, and I'll talk about that in a second. While the embalmer is embalming the body, he's going to be using massage cream, and he's going to be massaging your limbs, your hands, your feet, your legs, and the trunk of your body with a light massage to help those fluids go to those tissues.
Wow.
A bad embalmer.
I never knew that one.
No, well, a good embalmer that's good at what he does is going to be working with that body to break up clots, get really good fluid distribution amongst the tissues, and to make sure that your face is clearing, that your neck is not swelling, because you're injecting near the head, there's a possibility of swelling around the lips and the eyes. A few years ago, I knew an embalmer who said, oh, I just light a cigarette and go out and smoke and just come back and worry and look at it later. Well, bad plan.
Right.
It's a surgical procedure.
Wow.
A good embalmer that's really good at what he does is going to be there. He's going to work with the body. He's going to massage the body. He's going to try to get out every clot that he can. He's going to try to remove as much blood as he can. The average body holds about 4 to 5 liters, about 1.5 gallons of blood in the body. In an embalming process, will not get all of the blood out because there are some tissues that it's impossible to get out. But you're going to inject probably 3 to 4 gallons of embalming fluid mixed with water, and that pretty much takes care of the arterial system. Now, do you want to hear about the remainder of the process?
No, that's just too much. I'm done. Oh, my gosh. That just even hearing about the massage thing, that's crazy. But then I guess you have to deal with the organs and everything else. One of my questions is that I've always noticed, and I think I know the answer, but I'm not sure. I've always noticed that I think what happens when we pass is our jaws are open and they stay open. Is
correct.
That right? It seems like, yeah. Tell me about that, because
correct. At right at death, you have a thing that's called primary flaccidity, which is a total relaxation of all the muscles in your body. That happens immediately upon death. You just like go limp. Your mouth sags, your eyes droop. you're totally relaxed. That is usually passes within a few hours, because after 3 to 4 hours, there's a thing called, you've heard of rigor mortis.
Easy for you to say.
Rigor mortis is the stiffening in the body. That starts within 3 to 4 hours after death.
Right.
Usually is at its maximum at 12 hours after death. And usually after 12 hours, rigor mortis leaves the body, and again, it becomes relaxed all over again. So within 20 or 24 hours after death, the body, if it's not embalmed, will become totally relaxed again. But because of the relaxation process at death, the mouth does indeed have to be closed physically, and there are a couple of different means that we have to close the mouth.
Yeah, how do you do that? Because that's what I've seen the most, that's very awkward when I've seen anybody at a viewing.
Yeah, have you witnessed that people just didn't look like themselves because of the mouth closure, or?
It just looks like they've been sewn together.
Okay. Yeah, and this is something, too, that a good funeral director is going to ask a family for at the time of arrangements, Connie, is pictures of the deceased. Give me a picture, two or three, of what this person looked like, even if it's before I embalm or after I embalm, so I'll know what they look like. How do you want this person to appear? And the whole process is to try to make the person look as much like they did in life, you know, after they passed.
Yeah.
So the mouth closure can be very difficult. Some people just have bad mouth closures, but there's a couple of different ways we do it. A lot of people think that a mouth is glued shut, and that's really not done. There's what they call a dental tie, which is a piece of ligature that's on a needle, and you go in and between the lip and the bottom jaw and the upper, there's actually a piece of ligature that's put in a circular, and the jaw is put up, and it's actually tied shut. Most people don't use that. There's an instrument called a needle injector, which is what most funeral homes use now. It's like a little staple gun, and it just puts a staple in the upper and the lower, over the upper teeth, below the bottom teeth, and there's a little wire, and the two wires are put together. And you take a little piece of maybe a small pair of pliers, and you twist the two pieces of wire together, and it pulls the mouth shut. But the important thing in a good mouth closure is to have lots of massage cream to keep the mouth moist and the lips moist, and to get the lips set in a natural pose.
Oh, okay, that makes sense.
There's quite a lot to it. And that's if it's a natural death. It's usually not too difficult, but sometimes a director will have a problem with a mouth closure. But as I say, the objective is to try to make the person look as much as possible in death as they did in life, because that's what it's all about.
You guys do a lot of work when there's like makeup artists. You're kind of like that, too, especially when somebody has really torn up their face or things like that.
Yeah, those are
you guys rebuild.
Yeah, those are very difficult cases. Trauma injuries, automobile accidents, suicide, homicide, where there's facial injuries are very, very difficult for funeral directors to work with. But there are a number of products made in the funeral industry now for closing wounds, a number of different waxes and other compounds to help put people back together again, trying to make them look as natural as possible. Sometimes you can, sometimes you can't. I've been very lucky over the years. I was only one or two people that I was not able to show to the public, but I was able to show to the family, because I would put a veil over the casket even after the post-death work was done on the facial features. They were able to see the person. But some injuries are just so bad that they're very difficult to work with.
Yeah, I guess some closed caskets work for that when that happens. I know that some people put things into people's caskets before they go on. What are some of the craziest or significant ones?
I have a great list of that.
Oh, good. Okay.
for centuries, people have been started with the Egyptians putting things in the pyramids.
Oh, right, sure.
You know, and to go on to the afterlife. And here is a list of some of the things that I have placed either in a casket or with an urn. Coins in a pocket to cover the first bet at the track of this fellow that passed away.
All right.
A six-pack of beer. A bottle of scotch.
This is what they're buried with, correct?
Yes.
Oh, I love it. Okay.
Were put in and not retrieved.
Excellent.
Two six-packs of beer.
It had to be two.
hockey stick. A check for $250. The friend owed him money.
Oh, wow. I love it.
a fork in the lady's hand, and I'll tell you the story about that later on if you've never heard about it. A fork in the lady's hand. Naturally, a next of kin pictures are very popular. Crucifixes. Unusual ones I buried of a bowling pin, a bowling ball, two separate cases, decks of cards, flasks, candy bars, clean socks. I'm not sure what the reason for those were. A highway map, an Afghan, books and Bibles, a flashlight, records and tapes. A church key. Most younger people don't know what a church key is. Dominoes. Pet cremains. People have asked to have their pet cremains buried with them upon their death. That does happen.
What if their pet has not passed yet?
Then that's a problem.
Yes, yes, it is. That pet must run away.
There have been requests over the years. People want their pets buried with them, and a lot of cemeteries will not bury pet cremains with humans. A lot of the cemeteries are really strict about that. They don't want pet cremains mingled with human remains. That's understandable.
Why is that?
It's just, you know, I don't know. Pets are part of the family. My beagle's part of my family.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And, some cemeteries have very strict regulations about that, so usually it's just done and no one is told about it at the time, but it does happen. Buried lots of toys, Hot Wheels, die-cast, stuffed animals, some jewelry. I never recommend burying jewelry with the deceased other than a wedding band. I did witness a very, very expensive diamond that was buried with this lady when I did my residency 35 years ago. And the husband.
And where exactly? Where exactly is that grave?
And he said, "No, this was hers. It was our 60th anniversary. It was a very expensive diamond." And he buried it with her, and it's still with her, and that was in 1978, I believe. But that's very rare. Most people wouldn't want to do that. Those things, jewelry you want to pass on to next of kin.
That's true.
And let's see other things. A mirror, grocery store apron, baseball cards, Star Wars lightsaber. So that's just...
That's interesting. And a lot of this all did start with the Egyptians, didn't it? With,
It did.
Burying things and embalming.
Yeah, they're still finding burial mounds and tombs in Egypt where lots of things were buried with that person to go to the afterlife, and pictures. People still come in and take, and that's a whole other story of people taking pictures of the deceased. That still happens a lot.
I got to tell you, I mean, just that whole procedure and every thought of what to do and how to do it, I mean... It's almost like just drop me in a hole and throw some dirt on me, folks. But there's a lot to it, without a doubt. We're talking with Stanley Swan, and he is telling us what it's like to be a funeral director. So stay with us, because we're going to talk to him about the World Trade Center and Hurricane Katrina and what he did after those tragedies occurred. And you've got it tuned in to Coast AM. Peter Frampton, that was back in his hair days, and he had some great hair. Holy cow. Frampton. You just go back to that poster, right? Everybody have that poster on their door or on their wall? Yep. My friends all did. I wasn't allowed to, but my friends did. Anyway, hope you guys are having a great night. It's a very interesting show. Thanks for all the great emails that you guys are sending and the texts. I appreciate all that. If you've never got to see George's show, okay, definitely you hear him on the radio. Of course, he's awesome. But have you checked him out on his internet TV show? Beyond Belief. Great name as well. This guy is good with names without a doubt, isn't he? Well, you can sign up to see him on TV, his internet TV show. It's only 99 cents for the first month, and that's at beyondbelief.com. And he's got a ton of great shows to watch from the past that are archived and have definitely some more to come. It's really, really interesting. So if you want to, go ahead and check out the trailer. It's on coasttocoastam.com and watch George on his internet TV show. More coming up with Stanley Swan here on Coast to Coast AM. It's another very interesting show here on Coast to Coast AM, the real theater of the mind. And Stanley Swan, mortician, is really giving us a theater of the mind, especially Stanley with that massaging part of the embalming part. Had no idea of that. We were all kind of discussing that a little bit. Ooh, blah, blah, blah. I got to ask, did you get married and then do this? Because I would imagine it would be very hard to get a date if they knew some of the things you were doing.
Well, you know, and...
Or did you have trouble in that area?
I think a lot of people around the country have always thought that people in the funeral business were kind of strange. And we're really not. We're just average people. There probably are a few strangers or strange people in our business. There's strange people who are attorneys and strange people in other professions. I think we're pretty much... just average people who've been called to do the work that we do. And on your question about my wife, we actually met just as I was finishing mortuary school and doing my residency here near Rochester, New York. And she was always wanted to be a nurse, a registered nurse. So soon after we bought our funeral home in 1983, she went back to college and got her RN. And so I was practicing funeral directing, and she was practicing nursing. And she was helping me many times in the operating room, preparation room at night, if I needed a third hand or a third eye to help me with a problem. And I couldn't have done it without her.
Yeah. Well, that's perfect. That's a perfect setup for both of you.
Yeah, it worked out very well. And I know a lot of people in our business who have their spouse, either men, the husband or the wife, in a related field. And there are a lot of gals going into funeral service. I trained two gals pretty much in the last few years in funeral service, and you're seeing a lot more ladies in the profession now, and I think that's wonderful.
Well, there's a lot of security in it, and they're always going to have business, that's for sure. I had somebody write in, a couple different people write in and question this, so I want to ask it to you. You had mentioned that the human body is 98% water, and I've got a bunch of emails saying, no, it's less than that, and blah, 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 blah. So I wanted you to answer that so no one would have to call about it.
You know, at my age, the numbers may not be exactly correct, but, you know, it's... I give a percentage or two, you know, but I'm not near a computer, so. But people can fax check almost anything today. But upon cremation, you pretty much do dissipate, other than what's left. So.
Well, we have all talked about how much detail is involved in this, and it's quite a bit for sure. I know that at one part in your life as well, you were in the corrections business with the local sheriff's department. In doing that and doing this, it seems like that really made a difference of why you helped out with the World Trade Center and Hurricane Katrina. Is that correct? And can you tell us about the World Trade Center first?
Yeah, that was correct. I was employed in corrections with the sheriff's department in Belmont, New York, Allegheny County, New York State. And at the time that the towers fell, that day, we were out doing some range work with our qualifying with our weapons that day when the towers fell. And soon after, within a day or two, the word went out from people in New York City that they needed security people to come to New York to handle security, etc. And our sheriff's department received that request And our sheriff picked myself and four other individuals to go to New York with him. Because I had the funeral credentials, they thought that would be extremely helpful once we got there.
Sure.
And so about 10 days after the towers fell, we drove to New York City, and we spent about 9 or 10 days there doing security work, and many of us were actually in the field going through the remains of the buildings and looking for personals and remains. See, everything that happened in New York City and Manhattan, everything that was at the rubble pile was taken to across the river and was taken to Staten Island. And it was taken to a place called Fresh Kill, which is an awful name for a landfill.
Yeah, that's for sure.
Especially during that time. But it was called Fresh Kill. That was the name of the landfill at Staten Island. And everything was barged and trucked to Staten Island. And it was there that these teams of people, and there were dozens and dozens of people like myself, in full protective gear, breathers, rebreathers, masks, gloves, Tyvek suits, they call them, which is a white apron that you wear, it zips up. We were actually going through, they would scatter all the debris out on a field about the size of a football field. And then we would get and go from side to side and work our way through the debris field looking for personals and or remains if we could find anything. And it was...
What was that like?
It was a chilling experience. It was very humbling. It was awesome. It was breathtaking. Just to be a part of that, and I look back at it now and I think, boy, how did a fifth-generation farm boy from rural New York State end up involved in the most calamitous thing really that's ever happened within our country, with almost 3,000 people being killed that day?
Mm-hmm.
And it's still chilling to think about it. We did find some partial remains, but very few, and more personals of anything, jewelry, shoes, wallets, credit cards, and those things were all logged in there, and tried to get those things eventually back to the family members. But the towers, it was such a terrible tragedy and loss of life, and so many families that lost people at the towers, Connie, never got anything back. A lot of people never received any remains back from their loved ones, and that was very sad, very sad.
Yeah, I've been told stories and read about the fact that they're still finding some things once in a while, right?
Yeah, years after they were finding bone fragments on roofs in some buildings that were around the towers and in sluice pipes and places that were just never really checked. And yeah, so, and there's still, I think the last thing that I read, the medical examiner in New York City, they were going to take the final number of remains that they couldn't identify, and they were going to do a mass burial, I believe, of the things that weren't identified. But it was a sad time for the country, and we hope that we never have to go through that again. But for me, it was... it was probably one of the things in funeral service that really took my breath away, because it was a chilling experience to be in part of. Really, when we got to Manhattan the first night we arrived, we walked into the scene, and it was raining, and the firemen are still in there trying to look for survivors, you know, and trying to find people who had been killed, and we're standing there in floodlights and rain coming down and smoke, and here's an 18-story rubble pile in front of us, and you're just standing there in awe thinking that, wow, here's a 100-story building which is now reduced to just rubble. And it was an unbelievable experience.
Yeah, I could not believe that. Just a couple of weeks before, I was up on the building looking down, you know, and getting the picture taken and doing that little tour of the World Trade Center. So, and it was a very eerie feeling when I was there, and it was all good. So that's kind of
right.
Another story as well. But you also helped out with Katrina.
Yeah, soon after 9/11 and after we did our recovery work there, I had talked to some people there who are members of a national recovery team that, you know, are employed by the government. And they invited me to join, to become a member of their recovery team. So I put an application in soon after 9/11, and about 9 or 10, 12 months later, after the application was reviewed and background investigations, et cetera, I was received into that group. So did some training with them. They're a national group that, goes on disasters, and then was able to go to Gulfport, Mississippi for the recovery at Katrina. That was in the fall of 2005, and Katrina was unreal, 1,800. Some people lost their lives there. It was worst hurricane damage since Hurricane Andrew in 1992. The effects of the water coming through Mississippi and Louisiana were catastrophic. And to walk into that area and see what a 22-foot wall of water would do was just unbelievable. We went to a few cemeteries that were actually washed. A lot of cemeteries had caskets pulled out of the ground, crypts that were opened up, caskets that were pulled out and washed inland, many out to sea. Many were never recovered. And they're still recovering from Katrina. This 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 years later, they're still working at putting that area back to shape. But that was an interesting recovery operation there. We had set up at an airport, at a hangar in Gulfport where we did our work. And as the remains of people were being found, they were being brought into the hangar where we did our work. And they were going through the process of being photographed, fingerprinted, and trying to find out their identities and processed and trying to find the next of kin and trying to get those back to their families. And that wasn't quite as chilling as 9/11, but it was, again, a very humbling experience when you're involved with a campaign like that. There were so many people that did such good work down there. And years after Katrina, they were still finding from time to time some remains that were washed, covered with dirt, mud, buildings, and unbelievable devastation that you'd think that water could do the kind of damage that was done. So.
Mm-hmm. You've gone through some tough stuff. How do you sleep at night? I mean, I guess, you know, do they prepare you mentally when you go to school for this?
Well, they do, and you have to. I know when we did the recovery at Katrina, you have to go through a mental health examination before you're released from deployment. They want to make sure that you're okay mentally, you know, before you go home, go back to your regular norm. And as I said at the onset of our discussion tonight, people in funeral service really have to keep themselves mentally active and try to stay happy. I've really never been depressed by the funeral business. Both of my parents were deceased within the last 15 years. That was very difficult. I thought it would help being a funeral director, but it didn't. But I think most people in our business have to have hobbies and things to keep themselves mentally up, because a lot of funeral directors I've known over the years have become alcoholic.
Well, absolutely.
Have had drug problems, you know.
I can see that.
Like, well, why would that be?
Oh, my gosh, I'm being brought down myself. I mean, I want to take you on a roller coaster ride or something over at Kings Island or something.
But that's why I say you have to be light. I think the years that I spent on the air helped, because I was kind of an entertaining guy when I was on the air, and I think that's helped me in my career to try to stay mentally up, you know.
Yeah, we got to keep you up here. Yeah. Well, what about what happens? Let me ask this. I remember as a kid, I remember people talking about in Japan that there were so many people, I think it was Japan, there were so many people, or maybe it was Hawaii. Anyway, they were buried standing up because there were so many people and not enough land. Is that true?
I have not seen that documented, but it does happen in some major cities in our country. most little cemeteries or regular cemeteries may only bury maybe what we'd call one deep, where you have just one body in a casket in a vault. But in some city cemeteries, and I believe in the New York metropolitan area, there are some cemeteries that bury more than that deep. They might go down 2, 3, or 4 deep and bury vault on top of vault on top of vault. As far as standing, burying them standing up, I've read about that, but I don't know that I've ever seen it.
Oh, okay.
In print. I'm sure it does happen somewhere in the world where land is of is sparse and they don't have a lot of room to work with, and a lot of the city cemeteries in this country are getting kind of crowded because they keep building and building and building, and you'll drive through some areas and you'll see, wow, all of a sudden there's a little cemetery out in the middle of a busy intersection.
Yeah.
And, the last thing that a community wants to do is to ever move a cemetery. They'll do anything possible not to disturb graves. Pardon me. You know, they want to keep people at their resting place. I have seen places where who have built, there was a dam built in Pennsylvania not too far from where we lived years ago, and they actually went and moved a whole cemetery. A couple hundred people were actually disinterred and moved with stones and everything. And what a massive, massive job.
Right. I thought you were never supposed to do that. I mean, any of us that are coast to coasters, I mean, we all know, too, that you never do that and you never put your house on something like that. So we know that ourselves. That's
like the movie Poltergeist.
Oh, well, without a doubt. That sounds like some of the stuff you were seeing over in Katrina, which doesn't sound good at all. But yeah. So let me ask you, what happens with homeless and what happens with animals?
With homeless people, most cities now, if there's a person that passes away and they do not have a next of kin, and they have no money, and they have no worldly possessions, usually the city or the county in which they live will step up and provide burial funds to bury that person. And they'll buy a grave and buy a very simple casket and take the person out and have them buried. I believe that's still going on. I believe on Rikers Island, I believe that some of the homeless in New York City are still being buried out there weekly. And most major cities have a place for destitute people who have no immediate family. It's sad to see people being buried. Of course, they have to keep really good records of where that person's being buried in case some down the road would come looking for that person. They naturally want to know where they were. I've been fortunate in the years. I've had a few funerals in my life where it was kind of sad, where there was no family. There would be just a minister, myself and my wife, and maybe one person sitting in the front row for a service because there was no family. That's kind of sad. When you go through life and all of a sudden you pass away and you've got no one to come to your final disposition, it's kind of a sad thing.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. We got to tell some of them funeral jokes to lighten back up again. Yeah, it's a sad thing to talk about this, but it is absolutely what happens to us, all of us. So it's nice to know to learn what happens and also how to take care of each other before it happens. To be a little easier as well to get things done when that does occur. So we are talking with Stanley Swan, funeral director, and we are going to take some calls next hour. You'll get to talk with Stan and ask him anything you've wanted to ask about what happens next with you physically. So please hang out, give us a call, give your question to him instead of me, and let's see what he says here at Coast to Coast AM.